Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in an ongoing series from the Institute of Leadership and Management. This week we'll be discussing leadership issues which have made the newsstands during the week up to the 29th of March 2019. My name's Nick Scott. I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute of Leadership and Management, and I'm joined today by Kate Cooper, the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
Psychologist Devon Price has challenged the view that staff who tend to procrastinate are lazy, weak-willed or lacking motivation. Writing on the website medium.com, he argues that often these workers face a mental health challenge, which is causing them to put off getting certain things done. The typical approach to those who put things off tends to assume either a lack of desire or moral weakness or both. But he argues this fails to acknowledge either a possible confusion about how to get started or anxiety around poor performance or fear of failure. Price states that people do not choose to fail or disappoint. So, Kate, do you think he has a point? Or is it reasonable to think that workers should assume responsibility for self-management and accountability when progressing their work profile?
Procrastination does seem to be part of the human condition because we all understand what people talk about when they talk about procrastination. It's putting things off till the last possible moment, or even worse, missing a deadline altogether, so that whatever the task is, you've either let somebody down or it's no longer worth doing. Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels wrote a book some years ago called The Tools and identified 5 ways to improve your life. And dealing with procrastination was one of the key features that they focused on. I do know people often suggest that they need the adrenaline push of the deadline to make them complete a task. But we do tend to put off things that we don't really enjoy. So if people are leaving things to the last minute but still get to the finishing line, I think that's just about a particular style and ways people like to work. If the earlier case I outlined, that they're missing deadlines altogether, that's a much more serious problem. But I think we need to recognise that procrastination isn't just about laziness or an unwillingness to engage with our work. It can often be we might not understand fully what's expected of us. We don't realise that other people are depending on what we're doing in order for them to do their jobs properly. So there's a lot of relationship dynamics going on here when it comes to completing or not completing tasks. Not completing something that someone's expecting of you is quite a passive-aggressive way of going about your work. And I think these are the conversations that managers should be having. Why are you putting this off? What's that telling us? How can I help you make sure that this isn't a continued pattern of behaviour?
Our second story this week asks if performance-related pay might be too stressful for staff. A joint study by Washington University in the US and Aarhus University in Denmark reveals that once firms introduce performance-based pay policies, the number of staff taking anxiety and depression drugs almost doubles. The research found that older workers with reduced labour mobility are the main group suffering these raised levels of stress and are addressing this through medication. So, are the upsides of better focus and the potential for increased performance worth these mental health risks?
The immediate answer, of course, is no. Having administered and been part of performance-related pay schemes myself, the range of responses that you get to that aspect, especially if it's only a proportion of the pay that's performance-related, which is normally the case, some people take the part of their work that attracts the bonus or the meeting of the objective that you need for PRP very seriously, and some take no notice at all. Others craft their objectives in such a way that it's work they're going to do anyway, so there's no extra effort involved. And this is a very stressful thing, not only for the individuals, but also for the manager who's making these judgments. Because what we don't know is the significance or importance that these bonuses, these extra part of pay, have for the individual at a moment in time. For some people, it's absolutely crucial that they hit their targets in order to achieve the performance-related pay. And if there's a concern that that's not going to happen and they're aware of the impact that that has on the rest of their lives, yes, they will be seriously stressed.
Our third story considers how best to make use of exit interviews. Jonathan Rivett, writing in the Sydney Morning Herald, argues that exit interviews serve two main purposes. Catharsis, allowing the departing employee to unburden themselves of frustrations they didn't feel able to articulate while in post, and criticism, theoretically at least, allowing organisations to improve. He quotes psychologist Jasmine Sliger, who argues that often information from these interviews, which are normally intended to be private and confidential, can be used in organisational politics, where one manager uses these anecdotal tales to decry others. So the question is, how can firms position and structure exit interviews to get the best outcomes for everyone?
I don't think it's just exit interviews where this sort of politicking goes on. Any platform that enables one to criticise one's colleagues, if that's what one wants to do, will be used. There's something about an exit interview that's quite attractive. It closes the loop, follows the employee from recruitment, induction to leaving. I think it has an important role to play if it is taken seriously, if it is an opportunity to gather feedback about why they're leaving. But when an employee leaves an organisation, they become an ambassador or a critic of that organisation. Surely we want people to leave our organisations with pleasant memories and good things to say about us. That exit interview, if it is cathartic, might be a great opportunity to enable somebody to discuss their frustrations, if they had any, and to create a narrative that actually is useful for them going forward. Because if somebody joins an organisation and is incredibly critical about their last employer, it often tells you more about them than it actually tells you about the organisation they used to work for. So that brand management, whether it's at the personal level of the individual or at the higher level of the organisation, is something that an exit interview can play an important part in managing.
And finally this week, I'm aware that the Institute's been very busy out and about in the country in the last couple of weeks. Perhaps you could give us an update on the Institute's public profile.
Yes, yesterday we were at a leadership conference organised by BQF, formerly known as the British Quality Foundation, hosted by GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, where we were talking about the importance of authentic leadership and what that is like on a daily basis. Next week, we're in Glasgow, where we're running one of our own conferences, again looking at leadership of and for the future with a different take, is the way we like to approach this. We've got Stephen Greer from Microsoft in Scotland speaking to us, Joe Keeler of Belbin looking at teams of the future, and by popular request, Steve Wells, global futurist, again giving us those big broad picture about what the future of work and the role of leaders within it might be.
Well, sadly, we're out of time. We'll be back next week with more leadership and management stories from around the news outlets. So please subscribe to this podcast series via iTunes or Spotify. Or, alternatively, visit the website www.institutelm.com, where you can find this podcast, the weekly webinar series, and other resources which are freely available.